Hello and welcome to episode 26 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man and my name is Graham Lee. I wanted to talk in this episode about the fact that I could often do with a little more software engineering in my life. I don't mean more projects. I've got two projects at work which both managed to, or rather each managed to distract me from the other at various opportunities, and obviously do a lot of sort of professional outreach and experience sharing with like podcasts and books and so on. More on that later. What I mean is that a little bit of baby was thrown out with the software engineering bathwater around the turn of the millennium, and I'd like to gain some of that back. So the first thing we have to ask is, what was the software engineering that was reacted to by people like the Agile Alliance, which was these sort of lightweight methods group, people like Pete McBreen, who created the Software Craftsmanship book. What was it that they were trying to propose an alternative to? And I think there's a good discussion of that thing in which they were in opposition, or rather to which they were in opposition, in Pete McBreen's book, Software Craftsmanship, The New Imperative. It is not, I think, a fair discussion of what software engineering actually was or entailed, but it definitely demonstrates the things to which the Agile and Craftsmanship movements and extreme programming and so on were in opposition with. It represents what they were countering. So the idea of software engineering is the idea that you can create a sort of reliable, repeatable, as far as is possible, automated process for generating software, or for running a software project anyway. And the things that that people didn't like about that idea and about the processes around it were, one, the processes were very heavyweight. When the Agile Manifesto says we value working software over comprehensive documentation, what they're saying is the documentation should not be the artifact that you're trying to seek. You don't sign off when you've got the reports or the paperwork that allow you to proceed from one phase of the project to another. You sign off when you've got valuable software for your customers out of the end. And Pete McBreen argues against this by saying that because software development is knowledge work, not sort of rote work, those artifacts that are produced at the end of every phase are knowledge that needs to be transferred from the people doing one task, maybe it's the requirements gathering, to the people doing the next task, maybe it's the analysis of the software architecture. And that the documentation is an inefficient and incorrect way of doing this. That if what you're trying to do is model software production on manufacturing, then you could have division of labor, and you could have successive steps which take the output products of the previous step, the commodities that were produced, and use them as the input raw materials for the next step. Because if you're extracting sand from the ground and then using that sand in aggregate, and then using that aggregate in cement, and then using that cement to make a building. Like, you don't need to particularly give people knowledge at each step of that process. You need to give them the sand or the aggregate or whatever. But that's not true in software engineering, or rather in software construction, and that what we need is a different way of looking at the ways in which information gets transferred from one step to another, because it is information, and any attempt to sort of capture that or represent it in static form will be lossy. And so this is why, you know, mechanisms like XP value conversations over sort of produced documentation. The other thing that that was opposed by the sort of turn of the millennium movements in software construction was the perceived belittling of the software developer in the software engineering process. And like, that is, I think, the thing that comes across most vociferously in the first couple of parts of Software Craftsmanship, the New Imperative, that if you've got a process where all of the sort of knowledge is captured in the requirements engineering and analysis and then distilled into your architecture and high-level design and then refined in your detailed design, then the coding is essentially an automatable translation step. And indeed, there are projects where that has happened. The IBM Kix project for reconciling ATM transactions, which I've talked about before in this podcast, did like 9 months of analysis and like requirements engineering, and produced a mathematical, like, provable model. So he used formal methods to produce a mathematical model of how the software should work. And then what the software engineers wrote was a translator that could turn that into Java. And so the actual coding was automatic. And software was very low defect rate. And like, what McBreen is saying is that, you know, software development is actually a sort of expert technique. It's a craft. It's not a blue collar job, and, you know, we should be treated like professionals, and we shouldn't be beholden to the whims of managers who are, you know, trying to automate the sound of a job. But then his argument sort of shoots itself in the foot slightly, because he says that you know, one of the reasons that computer-aided software engineering tools, like these things that could generate code from, you know, typically UML diagrams or data flow diagrams or entity relation diagrams, or, you know, whatever sort of model you had produced, it's like model-driven software engineering idea. The reason that those didn't catch on is because the coding isn't the difficult part of the problem. The thinking is. But that kind of reinforces the software engineering mentality, I think. You know, if you don't think that the software is the hard bit, if you don't think that the coding is the hard bit, then of course you should automate it, because you don't want errors to be introduced in something that's like easy and low value. You want to focus all of your efforts on getting the high-risk, high-value parts, i.e. the requirements, understanding what the customer wants, what the problem is you're trying to solve. You ought to get that right. Now, of course, like, that understanding is going to be negotiated. It's not like a fact about the universe that you can pluck out of the air. It is the result of a process of dialogue between the engineering team and the customers. It is going to be modified by the introduction of the software itself. The idea that deploying version 1 changes the problems that the customer has. Maybe it solves some of their pre-existing problems. Maybe it introduces new problems, or maybe it surfaces existing problems that they were too busy to realize that they had. And so it is, you know, iterative, it is incremental, it is an ongoing dialectic process. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you should not try to automate the rest of the process. That can still be the hard part. So the things that were sort of discarded were the like waterfall phased approach. And again, McBreen has a bit of a dodgy argument for arguing against the waterfall phased approach. The fundamental argument that most people use against it is the cost of change curve. The idea that the later you discover a defect in relation to its introduction time, the more expensive it is to fix. And so if you have a process that doesn't let you give to the customer until you have fully implemented all of the system, then you don't find out that the requirements are wrong until deployment. And you know, you've spent a lot of effort on all of those intermediary steps that turn out to have done the wrong thing. And you know, so you've lost a lot of opportunity cost already. And then if going back and fixing it means going back and producing a new set of requirements, then you've got a very long process ahead of you of remediation as well. So yeah, the waterfall process, which was already being replaced by people you might consider traditional software engineers. You know, you look at Barry Beam, who wrote Software Engineering Economics, and his discussion of the spiral model, which is an iterative and incremental development model, or even the rational unified process, which allows some of these activities to be done in tandem, and for results from what you know, were previously considered later phases to be used in the earlier phases. That like this was already an idea that was being addressed. You have the waterfall model, you have the focus on artifacts, and you have the demotion of esteem of the software developer. You know, that they are doing some sort of labor task that can soon be automated away. And I think that there's, you know, there is definitely something in all of those ideas that but the reason that the development is a more important task is not because the coding itself, and indeed McBreen like sort of acknowledges this point, you know, that it's not that the development itself is where all of the like clever thinking goes on. The problem is that the software construction, the coding, is the only bit where like visible progress is made. You know, if you imagine like a car plant, it still takes, you know, years to design and build a new car. But once you've like tooled up your production line and you know, trained your workforce on what, you know, parts are going to go where and how they fit together, and you know, you've done all of your, before you've got to that point, you've done all your aerodynamic testing of your model and your refinement, and you know, maybe some form of customer feedback to see what they think of the model or what you know, features they'd like in their new vehicle. So it's a years-long process, at the end of which you're able to churn out a large number of cars in a fairly small amount of time. But getting to that point is incredibly difficult. In a software process, there's even less visibility because you don't have those, you know, it's very hard. People tried it, but it's very hard to like have a discussion over a collection of use case documents about what the software will do. You know, you need to have prototypes, and preferably functional prototypes, you know, something that came out of the sort of rapid application development movement. So it's not until you've got software that anyone can see any progress. So, like, you know, unfortunate problem one, all of that, like, thought that goes into knowing what software to develop doesn't appear to get you anywhere. Unfortunate problem number two, everything that happens downstream of the coding, so, like, the, you know, quality assurance, the integration testing, the making sure that the thing is actually, like, deployable and usable, none of that is visible either, because, you know, we're all measuring progress based on, like, how many features we shoveled in, not whether they are actually, like, you know, usable or used. Now, I realise that that's a very sort of glib and overarching general statement to make, and that various companies are using either analytics or customer interviews or feedback or whatever to capture some of that later information. But the point still stands that the software developer has a privileged position in the process because they are the person who's delivering the change that is most visible, not because they are necessarily providing the most, like, intellectually valuable part of the process. But the other thing that the software engineer does, or the software developer does, is that they interpret all of the knowledge that was gained up to the point where the software was created, where they committed fingers to keyboard or whatever input mechanism they're using. You know, the typing the code actually hasn't changed that much. You know, I don't care what new programming languages or, like, supposed new paradigms have been introduced over the last few years. There's fundamentally very little difference between something supposedly modern like Swift or Rust, between something that was created in the 80s like Objective-C or Haskell, and something that was created in even earlier times like Simula or Lisp. Like, you know, the amount of typing that goes in to creating a program of given complexity, and the amount of thinking about the program that has to happen in order to produce that program, has not fundamentally changed in decades. And that's one of the reasons that I said before that reasoning about code is a scam, which is a blog post I'll link to. What has changed is the expectation of what the software can do. And that has manifested in two ways. One is that the requirements are getting much more complex. You know, you could not have done Twitch, for example, in the 60s, both because the networking and computing capacity to shovel all that video around didn't exist, but also just because there was no, like, that was such an infeasible idea that it wasn't even a question that anyone would ask. No one would ask, could you do like live streaming this person's computer onto that person's computer, broadcast it across the world and have live interactive chat. Like, it wasn't a thing that could make sense within the context of computing as it existed at the time. So that's one way in which this complexity has become manifest, is that expectations have gone up. The other way is in the existence of reusable libraries, which allows us to tame the complexity by not actually writing any software that addresses it. And I think that, like, this is the way in which the software component and reuse battle was won. Not by object-oriented programming, not by functional programming, not by software ICs, not by any of these theoretical ideas of modularity. Because actually most of the modules we have completely artisanal, bespoke interfaces that you have to understand and implement afresh every time. What it was the open source software license. You know, the idea that you could freely take another component and reuse it for any purpose, and, you know, maybe there'd be some kudos available to the person who created it, but there certainly wasn't any money available. That was the thing that turned software into an industrial process rather than a craft process. So there we are. That's what the new thing was against. And I am suggesting that something has been lost along the way and that I would like to have it back. And it's not that much that I would like to have back. I would like to have traceability between the reason for doing something in the software and the demonstration that it has been done in the software. And I would like to have that for the purposes of understanding the software, not for the purposes of the Scrum Master or Product Manager beating everybody about the head. Because an irony of the supposed anti-management or anti-Taylorian management philosophy of like craftsmanship, XP and Agile is that we still have that Taylorian management science, because we haven't fundamentally changed the philosophy and education of the entire Western world. These ideas all typically coming out of the States. It's reasonable to look at the Western world as our source material. What we've done is changed the roles that you're allowed to have. So you no longer have a project manager, but you do have a product owner, and that person builds a list of what's going to be done over the next few months before splitting it up into sprints and then pretending that we're oh so agile, because our backlog of things that we are going to do over the next 6 months and our icebox of things that we are going to do over the next 2 years is being attacked in 2 week increments. We haven't changed anything at that point. Scrum Masters and product owners might use t-shirt sizes or story points, but like I've literally worked on a team where there was an expectation that the lead engineer could do a one story point task in 1 hour and an 8 story point task in a day, and that this was the sizing for story points. So we were literally tracking timesheets with a 1 hour granularity, but because we were oh so agile and using story points, we were like better than the people who actually had timesheets. Well, another project I worked on, there was, and I don't remember the numbers now, like the scale was different, but there was an expectation that the lead engineer could do like a certain number of story points, say 10 in a given amount of time. And so, yeah, we were still doing time tracking. We were still producing Gantt charts. Maybe we didn't discuss it with the engineers. We certainly discussed it with the customers on the product roadmap. Yeah, go to our the massive industry conference in 2018 and say, here are the features we'll have in 2019, 2020 and 2021. So there's 3 years of project planned. There's a Gantt chart of how our resources will allow us to implement that project plan and the order in which we'll do it. But if we break a chunk off every 2 weeks, then we're agile, right? No, the reason that I want the traceability is I want to understand why the software is in the state it is. You know, the sort of use the source loop community can tell me what state the software is in, and the version control will tell me a very, very inaccurate picture of how it got there, particularly if people are using squashes or interactive rebases or whatever to hide all of the experiments they tried before they found the thing that will work. Or if they're using test or commit and revert. It's test and commit or revert, isn't it? The workflow from Kent Beck where you propose a change, you implement that change and you implement the test for it and you discard it as soon as it fails. Well, now I haven't got any of the information about what you tried. I certainly haven't got any of the information about why you tried it. All I've got is whatever it was you finally decided was good enough to throw in, and no understanding of why you thought that it was good enough or what it was good enough at. So I would like that. I would like enough information about the design of the software system at a high level and the problem it is trying to solve, that if the lead engineer has left the company or is not available on the day that I join or is not available to answer a question at the time that I have that question, I can still piece that information together myself. And I frequently discover that this is lacking. You know, I frequently discover that the supposed, oh, you just check out this project and then run NPM test and it sorts out the Docker Compose and it sorts out the modules you need or whatever. I frequently discover that that is not actually true. And I would also like some of this, what was thrown out as ceremony, but I would like it to still exist because in some cases it is easier to have the conversation with the customer around a high level idea of what the software does than it is around the source code. If we've tried the cucumber behavior driven development test, we've tried the, oh well, now our business analysts can write the tests. No, that doesn't work. What we want is a conversation mechanism that happens between I need it to be able to do this and I have implemented what I understand of what I think you said, that allows us to refine that information and refine that understanding. And yes, that refinement is going to happen through dialectic. It's going to happen through conversation. It's going to be a peer-driven conversation between the creator and the effectively the patron, the person who has the need that is being satisfied. But that doesn't mean that all of the information has to be lost in that conversation. It doesn't mean that once that conversation is finished and the code has been constructed, that all other information about the project is now redundant and can be discarded. Because when the customer comes back later and says, and now I needed to do this, and we look at the code and it does something different that's kind of incompatible at a conceptual level with that, we need to be able to say something more substantial than, oh, but you told me it should work like this. No, we need to be able to say, here's the understanding that we built. Here's why we chose the decisions that led to this point. Here's where that is incompatible. Now can we discuss what the resolution is and what the way forward is? And if we don't have all of this other information, then we're basically relying on the professional and the customer, both at every point, taking a sort of collegial and non-adversarial approach to each other, which is, of course, ideal and does occasionally happen, but also relying on them reconstructing all of that shared understanding anew, potentially every time that this happens, or certainly like much more frequently than we need, when we've got these amazing like information storage and retrieval systems in front of us, and it's crazy that we refuse to store and retrieve information about the construction of information storage and retrieval systems. So yes, I would like a little bit more software engineering in my life, please. So before wrapping up, I wanted to talk about the fact that I actually put quite a lot of effort into communicating the experiences that I've gained over the last, 17 years professionally, and you know, longer than that as an enthusiast in the sphere of software construction across multiple sectors, multiple technologies, multiple sort of sizes of company. If you can name it, I've probably seen it. And if you can name a failure in a software project, I have probably caused it to go wrong or seen it go wrong. And I like sharing that with you. I enjoy getting involved in these discussions about software engineering practices. I enjoy researching both new ways of doing things and the old ways that have been tried before and what it was about them that didn't work, as in this episode. And I do that in a lot of ways. I have this podcast, as you are aware. I also blog at the same site. I produce a monthly programming magazine, De Programmatica Ipsum, with Adrian Kosmachevsky, once a month. I run two streams on Twitch with Stephen Baker. One is Dos Amigans, where we learn how to write Amiga software, bringing our modern sort of test-driven practices and development techniques to that context. And the other is Objective-C Retain, where we write modern free software Objective-C. All of this takes, as you can imagine, quite a long time to prepare and create and to present, and involves a lot of resources in terms of hosting for the podcast and for some of the videos that are produced. I didn't even mention all of the books I've written on software over time. There's a lot goes into them, and I don't want to put you under any obligation at all, but I do want to say that if you are able to and willing to just show your appreciation in a monetary fashion, once again, entirely not necessary, but I have opened a Patreon where if you enjoy the content that I write and want to help me to produce more of it, then you are welcome to sign up as a patron and to donate whatever you think that this is worth. So thanks very much for your time. As ever, you can contact me. Email is best, GrahamLee@acm.org. Thank you, and I will talk to you again next time.